Podcast. Dark Horse presents Aliens. Content. Comic book adaptations of 20th Century Fox intellectual property. Spoilers. Activated. Language censorship. Deactivated. Listener discretion. Advised. Initializing. Stand by.
Generally speaking, licensing tends to be king shit in comics. Arguably, you wouldn't have comics without licensing. In the early 20th century, you didn't have a lot of entertainment options. You could crank up the old vitriol if you wanted music on demand. You could turn on the radio, which also had news and plays and such. You had books that would occasionally have some pictures. And you had movies, which in the silent era would show you a little bit of footage. And then you'd have a title card explaining narration, dialogue, what have you. Pretty much the only option in order to see action occur while other forms of communication like dialogue are also occurring was in comic strips. Comic strips were hugely popular. Problem being, they're also extremely disposable. You'd be reading them one day, the next day they'd be in the gutter. But there were always aficionados. I think it may have been Michael Uslan, but there was one comic book luminary whose mother used to take comic strips and would actually sew them into linen and turn them into this fabric booklet. I remember back in the 90s or late 80s, we used to get a newspaper and I would paste, say, Robot Man strips or Mother Goose and Grimm into a blind tablet. That's the closest I ever came to that kind of devotion. But again, because of these aficionados, somebody finally got the idea, well, what if you made comic strips somewhat more permanent? What if you took a newspaper and folded it down and then stapled it and took the strips and turned them into a full serial, a comic book, if you will? They tried it a few times. It sold like gangbusters. These books had a reprints of popular strips of the day, things that everybody knew. But you know, there were a limited number of strips to begin with. The syndicates controlled most of them, and they wanted their money too. The profit potential of creating your own strips was high. These were enterprising young men in the ghettos, typically Jewish, Italian, Irish. Occasionally, you'd have a black fella in the mix. You know, you could always find somebody who was willing to hustle, who could do an Alex Waite Raymond swipe, who could string some words together. And that's how you ended up with original content. But the original comic books were licensed comic strips. Now, original comic book creations went on to be licensable, Superman being the most notable, one of the greatest brands in the world, certainly one of the most profitable. But not everybody can make a Superman. And superheroes in general lost favor with the public after the war, World War II. And because you're trying to hold on to audiences as they're gaining more and more entertainment options, comics became more sordid, more violent, more sexual. And then going into the 1950s, you had a juvenile delinquency epidemic. Surely this didn't have anything to do with kids going to school instead of being child labor once labor laws were in place to prevent children from losing their fingers in a factory somewhere. Couldn't be because they had access to their own automobiles so they could travel outside of towns instead of being stuck on foot or on bikes. Didn't have anything to do with them essentially being idle because they're going to school and they're bored. They're just waiting to become adults, essentially, especially the ones that aren't going to go into college. And so comic books become an easy scapegoat. Before long, you got the PTA getting together, going door to door, collecting comics, making a big old bonfire. And the comic book companies, they came up with stuff like the CCA to say, no, our comics are good and wholesome and the like, but nobody reads. If you're a reader, you probably wouldn't have been reading comic books, right? The comic books that continued to sell into the 50s and 60s tended to be licensed product because you didn't know one comic book character from another, but you knew who Mickey Mouse was. You knew Dobby Killis was a clean-cut kid. You could trust him with your children. The 50s and early 60s, Dell Western ruled the roost. They had all the great licenses. The ones they didn't have, DC tended to have. National Comics at the time, or National Periodical Publications. But then licensing ran into another problem. A lot of times you'd be licensing things like television shows. The immediacy and the production value of a television television show is going to be more appealing to most people than reading a comic book. It's also free if you don't count the power and the actual equipment and the like. But one advantage the comics had was permanence. In those days, if you saw a movie, once it left the theater, you had no way of knowing if you were ever going to see that movie again. Maybe it'd run on television, but not necessarily. And television was the same way. Some shows got syndicated, some didn't. If you watched an unpopular show first run, you might get two shots, the original broadcast and the repeat. But then after that, it might disappear from the waves forever. There were no movies on demand. You could buy a novelization or a comic book and relive a variation on the experience you had with a movie or a lost television show. You could do it economically, and you can keep it for as long as you wanted to. Marvel in the 1960s had a lot of success with original material, but by the 70s, a lot of those creators were leaving the field, the ones that made Marvel great. The new kids were promising, but they hadn't really come to fruition yet. Comic books in general just were losing popularity. They weren't as hip as they had been in the 60s. You didn't have Batman on television anymore to help promote them either. And so once again, licensing comes to save the day, because Marvel was a pretty small operation for most of its existence, at least through to the 80s, and they were on the verge of bankruptcy several times in the 70s because of mismanagement and just a lack of popularity. One of the things that saved Marvel in the early 70s was Roy Thomas bringing the Conan license in, which became this huge success. There wasn't really another way to enjoy Conan besides prose, and there hadn't been new stories written in decades probably at that point, or maybe there were a few. I don't know if they had started doing the revivals yet in the prose, but if you wanted to see the full visuals, and clearly Conan is a character that benefits from visuals, you pretty much could only get in comic books. The second time that Marvel Comics was saved was in the late 70s. I believe, again, it was Roy Thomas who got the license to Star Wars. There was nothing quite like Star Wars, even though Star Wars was hugely dependent on influences. Most of those influences were very dated, and they just didn't fill the same void that was left by what Star Wars had awakened in a generation of fans. And one of the only ways you could get new Star Wars adventures was through the comic books. Going into the 80s, though, Marvel was on much firmer ground. They were better managed. They were owned by a bigger company. They weren't as dependent on the licensing, even though some of their biggest hits were still licenses, like G.I. Joe and Transformers. Conan was still going strong at that point as well. Star Wars, less so. After the movies completed, I believe, 1983, there just wasn't as much demand. Darth Vader's dead. The story seems to have been wrapped up. The toy sales were slowing, the comic sales were slowing. They were still doing decent business, but you gotta figure it probably wasn't a cheap license. Ultimately, arguably in a moment of hubris, Marvel editor-in-chief Jim Shooter decided that he wanted to clear out a bunch of dead weight titles, anything that wasn't selling better than 100,000 copies or more. Actually, 100,000 was the minimum. They were probably selling more like 150,000, so again, 50% of the minimum amount that they should be selling to continue to be published by Marvel, but not good enough for Jim Shooter because he wanted to launch a brand new line of books to celebrate Marvel's 25th anniversary. The infamous New Universe, which also set him up to be fired as editor-in-chief. That, combined with Secret Wars 2, some of the shenanigans involved with that, really soured everybody at Marvel to him, and that's why he hit the bricks. The loss of licenses continued over at Marvel. Throughout the 80s especially, you did not get top talent on any licensed product. Even as popular as G.I. Joe was, you had older, long-in-the-tooth creators working on that for the most part, or guys who hadn't really had success anywhere but in the licensed materials. And then with other licensed goods, any movies, TV adaptations, that sort of thing, you tended to get the old fogies that just were not commercial anymore. And they just weren't as necessary because once you get into the 80s, you've got the VHS revolution. If you want to watch a movie again, you just pop it in your machine. Most of the movies that were ever available were available on VHS by the end of the 80s. So why not just watch the real thing instead of a imitation? Now, obviously there are benefits to adaptations. A lot of times they're adapting an earlier version of a screenplay, and they'll have, you know, stuff that was deleted and the like. But the problem is, oftentimes the story is so truncated, especially once Marvel was doing them, Marvel and DC, frankly, were doing them in a very perfunctory fashion. They tended to be very bare bones, just the bare minimum amount of story, 2 issues, 3 issues. So even if they had access to additional materials, they would often cut the same stuff that the movies were cutting. And so you didn't get a lot of benefit to reading the comic book version over the movie version. And so by the early 90s, G.I. Joe had ended. Transformers had ended, and ultimately Marvel did go into bankruptcy. Point being is neither Marvel nor DC were doing great with their licenses. Either they weren't getting good licenses, or the companies were failing the licenses by putting subpar talent on them. But there was still value in licenses. And in particular, a little company trying to get its start called Dark Horse. It had actually been a series of comic shops that decided they wanted to start producing actual comic books in the midst of the mid-80s black and white boom. And they got started with a title called Dark Horse Presents, which was an anthology. And it featured characters either created in-house or were creator-owned by people within the industry. They did okay with that, but the black and white boom busted. There was some question about whether or not that company was going to be able to continue, but they very smartly had made connections with 20th Century Fox, and they acquired the license to Aliens. The 1986 movie Aliens was a big hit. It was one of the hits of the summer. You had a rabid fan base without really any place else to go. There weren't any sequels immediately on the horizon. That was a movie whose sequels went directly to development hell. There were novels, I think, but I think it was just the novelization. I don't think they had any original adventures in that sphere. And so pretty much one of the only places you could get continuing Alien stories, probably the only place, was in comic books. Dark Horse did great business with their Aliens books. I remember back in the old days, you would know how popular comic book was in part by just looking at ads for mail order services and seeing what they were highlighting. And they were often highlighting Aliens. Dark Horse continued to do well with their licenses. They put the best people they could on them. They had very dynamic covers. They marketed them well. So by 1989, they had acquired the Predator license. Terminator eventually joined their stable as well. And because they were doing much better work with much better talent on these licenses, the licensors were happy to work with them. They became the industry titans of licensing. If you gave Dark Horse your license, you knew you would have a quality product that would keep the fans happy. And later on would be mined for IP. So again, Marvel lost or quit the Star Wars license, I believe around 1987. Dark Horse picks up in 1991, and they put out just a slew of licensed material. They did that until the year 2014, so about 23 years, nearly a quarter century. Keep in mind that Jim Shooter had canceled Star Wars at the 25th anniversary of Marvel to celebrate that event. Dark Horse had the license of Star Wars from Marvel for nearly the same length of time, and they committed to what you would call an expanded universe, where they filled in a story gaps from thousands of years of Star Wars continuity, working well with the novels, the video games, all this other ancillary material. They were the ones who produced books related to the prequel trilogy and helped expound upon that the same way the Clone Wars did. A lot of people, a generation of fans, lived their entire lives through this extended universe. There are people whose only nerddom is Star Wars, and one of the main avenues to explore that was in the novels and in the comic books. And then J.J. Abrams comes along and decides to do the same thing he did with Star Trek, to say that everything that happened before what he was doing doesn't count except for a few key moments. In his case, the prequel trilogy, the original trilogy, and Clone Wars, and then everything else didn't matter anymore, and he was going to chart an entirely new universe for Star Wars, same way he did with Star Trek, arguably wrecked both of those franchises, and he's moving on to Superman next. So I have a feeling that they're going to build a Wicker Mon Mothma for him at some point, and it's amazing the ego it takes to be so damaging to so many franchises. Be sure to check out the recent Hollywood Reporter story, The Resurrection of Kelly Marie Tran. I assure you, J.J. Abrams had nothing to do with that because he's a coward. But anyway, despite Dark Horse putting nearly a quarter century into Star Wars lore, they were willing to play along and produce material that related to just the core movies. But unfortunately, Lucasfilm was bought by Disney in 2012. And since Disney had also, by that point, bought Marvel, inevitably Star Wars was going to go back to Marvel. This actually occurred right around 2013, pretty much as soon as Lucasfilm could rip the license away from Dark Horse. The last Dark Horse Star Wars project was The Star Wars. This was an adaptation of earlier generations of the original Star Wars screenplay that George Lucas had done. They were vastly different from the finished film. These were legendary. Everybody who was a Star Wars fan knew that these prototypical versions of Star Wars existed, with these different versions of characters, different versions of the story, different designs. And so as a farewell parting gift to their fandom, Dark Horse had this lavishly illustrated by Mike Mayhew adaptation of the unused screenplay. Great send-off for Star Wars. Well, then comes 2019, when Disney proceeds to buy 20th Century Fox, the owners of all the other licenses that Dark Horse had supported themselves with. And once again, Dark Horse is in a position where they have to say goodbye to an even longer held license. They'd been producing Aliens comic books for 32 years by that point. they didn't put quite the amount of money into their send-off. The story really wasn't that different from the original. Also, maybe they learned their lesson from the Star Wars, because the transition from Dark Horse to Marvel meant that they lost a lot of the revenue that they should have gained from the Star Wars, because Marvel almost immediately put that into a collection and sold it under the Marvel brand. I'm not sure if Dark Horse gets any kind of money from this licensing. I know that they tend to be good to their creators and tended to give them decent royalties from what I understand, but I also understand that once Disney bought Lucasfilm, they cut off everybody that they could. There were a lot of novelists, I think, was it Timothy Zahn, who was complaining about not getting any royalties for several years after the sale. Corporations win again, which is an ongoing theme of the Aliens franchise. It's always an evil corporation ruining things for everybody.
Space freaks, welcome to the spaceship Vertigo, whose five-year mission is to seek out new life, have it baptized, teach it table manners, and find a creature who doesn't have to phone home. Ace Starfleet Commander Jay Jameson will give you a first-hand look at what space adventure is all about.
Never a moment's rest.
You'll be getting plenty of help from First Mate Rosinski.
Stand up, people. 8, 14, 7,
33 and a third.
5,
11,
joining
7.
Them are Morale Officer Annie McHugh.
Woo!
Hey, nice bot.
Ship's Dr. Stark. He's Stark Raven Man.
I need this organism. They'll have to call it the Stark Organism.
It was John who did discover the organism.
You're going to call it the John Organism?
And Captain Chef John. If you really want to get your rockets off...
I have to go to the bathroom, but I don't know if I'm a boy or a girl.
Take a ride on the only rocket ripping spaceship in the universe. Find out what 9 out of 10 alien creatures want for dessert.
I want to eat your face.
We don't want this piece of snot on board our spaceship.
It could just be so yummy. Your face in my tummy.
This creature means no harm.
Oh!
Remember, in spaceship, everyone can hear you scream. Spaceship, void where prohibited. See it, or we'll have to make a sequel.
Now, I personally am an Aliens fan. I came into the fandom in 1986 with the release of that movie. I was, of course, aware of the first movie, Alien. And I was also aware of Proto-Alien, this movie that the creators of Alien is supposed to have done. There was a prototype for the original movie. I never sought it out, and I never stumbled upon it in any 80s video stores, probably because it was too small of a movie. But probably another reason why I didn't seek it out was because one of the only issues of Fangoria I ever bought had an interview with Garrett Graham in it. And he was talking about having been in an Alien-type movie, a comedy, where he was pictured with Leslie Nielsen of Naked Gun fame. I had been a fan of Airplane and Naked Gun back in the day. I'm not that any longer for the most part, at least not in the case of Naked Gun. What I didn't realize is that I was confusing this alien prototype with an alien ripoff. 1983's The Creature Wasn't Nice, aka Naked Space and Spaceship. The movie also starred Laverne Shirley's Cindy Williams and the Avengers' Patrick McNee. Even though it's available free on YouTube, you should never watch that movie. It's pathetic and it is without any value. What you can do is watch Dark Star, which I presume was named after the Grateful Dead song. I looked around to see if it was available on any streaming services. It was not, but you could rent it for about $3 to $4. However, I stumbled upon it free again on YouTube. This was a low quality version. I found it late at night. I was basically trying to kill 15 minutes because I needed to do some more workout to get my steps in. So I took a break since I wasn't going to get any points for continuing to work out for those last 50 minutes. Just thought I'd start the movie and probably watch it in portions because I didn't think there was going to be much to it. It takes a few minutes to get going and you're trying to figure out what you're seeing. No, I watched the 15 minutes that I had planned to and I was still kind of intrigued, and then they started this section that runs about 20 minutes. The movie's kind of like a sketch show. There's bits, there's sections, and the early sections are shorter. You're not expecting this 20-minute segment, but that happens. I'm curious to see where that segment's going to go. So 20 minutes later, I'm about 45 minutes into the movie. The thing only runs about an hour and 20 minutes. So once you pass the 45-minute mark, why would you quit? It was holding my attention. Probably part of the reason for that it was written by Dan O'Bannon, who would, of course, go on to write Alien, create all the characters that form the basis of that franchise. He also did Return of the Living Dead, which is one of my favorite zombie movies. It's a great flick. Highly recommend that. It was also the first film directed by John Carpenter, one of the most famous horror and sci-fi directors of all time.
It is the future. Mankind has conquered the stars. He moves out to the endless interstellar reaches of the universe. An advanced exploration corps, a new breed of pioneer, must seek out unstable planets and destroy them.
Hyperdrive sequence begun. Hit it, Pinback.
Of the 21st century planet smashers, Dark Star. 20 years in space, 1 million light years from Earth. Their job is to clear a path for the colonization of space.
Back home in Malibu. I used to surf a lot, Talby. I used to be a great surfer.
Travel in an infinite universe. With mind-melting excitement from beyond the stars.
I must detonate.
Commander Powell, this is Doolittle. Can you hear me?
What happened, man?
Hey, Bob.
Confirm. Power drive sequence activated. Roger, retracted.
Lock all defensive systems.
Dark Star. They're not lost in space. They're loose.
Curiously, it wasn't actually a movie. It was a student film made for about $6,000 while they were at the University of South California. And you recognize that it's cheap from the very beginning. There's plenty of tells throughout the thing to show that it cost no money. But you wouldn't necessarily think it was a student film because it was so well done for how little money it was made for. They used the lack of budget to their advantage to make it quirky, to give you a claustrophobic feel, to give you a sense that this spaceship that the characters are riding in is this dilapidated wreck, and that they're taking their lives, well, really technically somebody else is taking their lives into their hands. But I don't want to spoil it for anybody. A lot of what makes the movie good is the discovery of not knowing where it's going, of not necessarily knowing the tone. It's sold as a comedy. It's not really funny ha-ha. It's more funny weird. You don't know how far they're willing to go with the material. You don't know if they're going to do horror stuff, especially given the involvement of Dan O'Bannon and John Carpenter. Even the parts that are supposed to be funny, you don't know that they're supposed to be funny necessarily. You're not necessarily going to be laughing at them. And in fact, sometimes they're suspenseful in part because you could definitely kill most, if not all, the characters of this movie and get away with it while still it being technically a comedy. It'd just be a dark comedy, which I assure you it is. I think it was John Carpenter who once said, "We had what would have been the world's most impressive student film, and it became the world's least impressive professional film." Dan O'Bannon was buddies with the infamous director John Landis, who helped connect them with distributors. They ended up getting another about $54,000 to turn the student film into a feature film, which had very small limited releases around 1974, 1975. The movie's a parody of 2001 A Space Odyssey. In place of HAL 9000, they have this female voice that helps control the ship, which is very reminiscent of Mother from the Alien movies.
Clean and service the electromagnetic coils in the bottom. It is necessary to jettison the access plate in the floor. To remove the floor plate, please press button number one. Attention, danger. Automatic charges will now blow the explosive bolts in the floor plate unit.
And as I'm watching it, I'm not sure how much it's really going to have to do with Alien. And then a moment comes up fairly early on in the movie where I'm Leonardo DiCaprio in the Barca Lounger with a beer in my hand, pointing at the screen going, "Canon. This is canon. All of this is clearly canon. You'll know it when you see it."
Thank you.
I've already featured the trailer audio earlier in this podcast. I edited that because I really think that going into this movie, you need to know as little as possible. If you're a fan of Alien, you're going to see a lot of Alien in this thing. With the talents gathered here, despite being very small potatoes in the grander scheme of things, I think if you're on the wavelength of guys like O'Bannon and Carpenter, you're going to enjoy it. I definitely enjoyed this movie more than I enjoyed a lot of John Carpenter's movies, especially the later stuff. Trust me, if you've got a choice between Ghosts of Mars and Dark Star, see Dark Star. Also, if you're a comic book fan, there's a few Easter eggs for you. The character of Sergeant Pinback, who is nominally the star of the movie. He takes up most of the space of the movie. There are other characters that are more heroic than him, but in terms of screen time, he is the strongest presence there, and he's a comic book fan. In the title credits, you see him reading a copy of DC's Falling in Love, and then later in the movie, you see him with a copy of the first series of Doctor Strange on his chest. The cover's by Gene Colan, so are the interiors. It's the shot where Clea is being dragged into a grave by a demonic hand, and Doctor Strange is trying to save her. If you've ever read that material, you know exactly the one I'm talking about. There's a lot of malfeasance in this movie. Seems to be government malfeasance in this one, but it's very similar to what you see with corporations in the Alien franchise. In terms of tone, while being lighter overall, and clearly owing a debt to 2001, among other things, it's very much of a piece with the other Alien movies, and you really ought to see it. There are a lot of notable talent involved with this. Literally, the worst thing about the movie is a sequence involving an alien, which has been described as a beach ball with teeth. I never saw the teeth. I only saw feet and hands, but otherwise it is clearly a giant inflatable beach ball that's been spray painted. But the beach ball happens to be played by Nick Castle, who would go on to play Michael Myers in the first Halloween movie. You've got design work by Greg Jean, who would go on to Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Next Generation, as well as Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You've got Ron Cobb, who is one of the main designers of Alien, particularly the elements that were created by humans. The Nostromo, the ship interiors, all the stuff that didn't involve the aliens or the alien worlds was largely Ron Cobb. And one of the very interesting thing is that the movie invented the visual language of hyperspace. No movie had ever done that thing that we see in most sci-fi movies these days where they jump to a higher speed and the stars become streaks and everything like that. The first time that was ever seen on film, strangely enough, is in this student film that was expounded upon, Dark Star. So check it out. After Dark Star, as O'Bannon is trying to continue his professional career, he had started out as an effects man and worked with Lucasfilm, among others, but he decided eventually that he wanted to focus on screenwriting. He wrote 29 pages of a script called Memory. The idea was he'd done this space comedy that, while people were watching it, they didn't necessarily perceive as comedy. They perceived it as a suspense movie or even a horror movie, and so O'Bannon decided, well, if I can't make him laugh, I want to make him scream. So he gets those pages done, and then he gets contacted by Alejandro Jodorowsky, famous cult director, midnight movie guy, El Topo. A month before Dark Star had been released, optioned Frank Herbert's Dune. There was actually a documentary done a number of years ago called Jodorowsky's Dune, which we covered on one of our other podcasts. It's the zero episode of Rolled Spine. So if you'd like, you can check that out. I'll maybe throw a link up. O'Bannon gets hired to work with Jodorowsky. I don't recall if he was in there as a screenwriter or if he was supposed to be there doing effects. He spends 6 months in Paris. The movie falls apart. He comes back to the U.S. broke and homeless. He's sleeping on Ronald Shusett's couch. Shusett had optioned Philip K. Dick's We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, which would eventually become Blade Runner. But in that time period, it was considered too expensive to produce, at least by the screenwriters. And so Shusett said, well, why don't we work on your script instead? O'Bannon had the first act, but not the rest of the story. He basically had it up to them finding the alien and then didn't know what to do with the alien. Shusett suggested O'Bannon merge his memory script with one he'd been considering about gremlins invading a B-17 bomber during World War II. Shusett helped to expand the story, but most importantly, he suggested the idea of the implanted embryo and chest burster. He figured that would be a good way for the alien to get onto the main ship. Shusett also had the industry connections that O'Bannon lacked, but otherwise the basics of Alien appear to be mostly O'Bannon's baby. The finished script by O'Bannon and Shusett was Star Beast, although they didn't really love the name, and eventually, recognizing that the word alien appeared often in the script, they just turned it simply into Alien. Shusett in particular particular like the way that it worked as both a noun and an adjective. The Star Beast script is the basis for the Dark Horse comic book. The characters are completely different. Nobody from Alien is in this particular script, but the bare bones of the plot are exactly the same. Captain Chaz Standard is an older Asian woman. Recalling Michelle Yeoh's Captain Georgiou on Star Trek Discovery, she replaces Tom Skerritt's Dallas from the Alien film. First Officer Martine Roby is an African-American woman with braids. She effectively replaces Ripley, but she's a much more timid character. Navigator Del Broussard is an average-build blonde dude. He replaces John Hurt's Kane, but he's a younger, adventurous guy. Engineer Jay Faust is a muscular black dude. He replaces Yaphet Kotto's Parker. Communications Officer Sandy Melkonis is an average-build brunette dude. He kind of, sort of, but not really replaces Ian Holmes' Ash. In this version of the script, he's just a curious guy who gets killed. He's not a synthetic or anything. You could easily argue that he replaces Veronica Cartwright's Lambert instead, but absent hysterics or homicidal treachery, he's mostly a cipher to add to the body count. Mining engineer Cleve Hunter is a muscular white dude. He replaces Harry Dean Stanton's Brett. You know it's the future because everyone has a side shave. If you go back to the original script, the authors note that the characters' genders are interchangeable. They put names down on paper and the filmmakers could decide who was going to fill those roles. They do have greater racial diversity and gender diversity in this version of the script, but the physical diversity is nil, and the characters as adapted or perhaps in the original script are fairly interchangeable. There's clearly still white privilege in the future because minor character Hunter gets every distinguishing feature. He's basically techno-Viking from the year 2000 meme. He's got long hair, side shaves, he's a ginger redhead with a full beard and a head tattoo and a facial scar. I really wish that these distinguishing characteristics had been spread out amongst the crew, because it's very easy to forget who is who while you're reading the book. Everybody's wearing uniforms that resemble the movie Prometheus. They're all gym rats. Everybody's hot. They borrow the scripted opening from, I don't know if it was Alien or Aliens, where the people who are in hyperspace sleep are supposed to be naked and they get up and they put their clothing on. Of course, being comic books, they're strategically placed nudity so you don't actually see anything, but you can tell that everybody's just got a great body. Nobody in this thing is out of shape. Nobody in this thing could be older than 45 at the latest, and that would be Techno-Viking. I think that I'm aging in because of the beard. Oh, I'll tell you what, the captain, the Asian woman, she's probably in her 40s or later, but she's still hot, so it doesn't matter. They just put some extra lines on her face. I made a point of not rewatching Alien before doing this read-through because I wanted to take the adaptation as purely as possible. So the color text on the inside front cover of the first issue of Dark Horse's Alien, the original screenplay, states that this is an adaptation of Dan O'Bannon's original 1976 screenplay, originally titled Star Beast. The visuals and the design of the ships and the alien are based on descriptions in the screenplay, which was written before the involvement of H.R. Giger, Moebius, or Ron Cobb. I have the hardcover version of the collected edition, which has a foreword by, I believe, Randy Stradley, who was one of the guys who'd been involved with Dark Horse's Aliens from the very beginning. And he noted that he really wanted these aliens to be distinct from the ones from the movies, and that he'd actually sent art back to become more alienated from the franchise itself. The idea was to do something new with this adaptation, not to just do a retread of the original movie, which had already been adapted to comic books. So as in the movie, the miners are talking about how they're soon to be rich. They've got this huge payload. They've made this personal sacrifice. It's been years and years out in space. They're going to get a percentage of their payload, and they're all going to be able to buy mansions at the very least. I think they're actually talking about buying their own islands and stuff with the money they're going to make off this. But they were awakened prematurely because the ship had picked up an alien signal, and they desired to make first contact. I don't know if humans had interacted with aliens by the time of the first Alien movie. I know that they had by Aliens, because they talk about fornicating with them. But in this version of the script, despite there being humans throughout the galaxy, and there's all these different languages and all these different cultures as a result, they're still all humans. They've not met any alien life forms, any intelligent life beyond actual human beings. And so again, there's no nefarious purpose to send them to investigate this signal. It's just that, hey, we might actually get to find the first aliens. How cool is that? They're already all going to be rich. So largely, they're motivated by the pursuit of discovery. The crew in this version of the story is much closer to Star Trek. They're much more, I wouldn't say utopian, because they're still clearly in a capitalist system, and they're all looking toward personal advantage, financial advantage. The flavor text from the second issue notes, the crew of the starship Snark intercepted a voice transmission, believed to be an SOS or first contact of non-human intelligence. The crew traced the source, leading them to a desolate planetoid. On its surface, they discovered a derelict spacecraft, and inside, the body of a petrified extraterrestrial who had been dead for centuries. Possibly being the single most important discovery in human history, only speculation remained. What happened happened and what killed it. An away ship lands on a planetoid. This place is filthy with contaminants. I believe it was metal of some kind. It clogs the engines of the away craft, stranding them there temporarily, and gave them very limited visibility. Once they decide to explore the surface, they can only see, I think, about 3 meters in front of them with the headgear they had. They do finally make their way to the alien spacecraft, which they say looks like Swiss cheese. It's got holes all over it. They make their way inside, and they see a cool new space jockey, which I think recalls Pyramid Head from Silent Hill, but spikier. They decapitate the space jockey so they can take the head back with them. Later on, a pyramid is discovered on the planetoid, and another away team goes out to check that out. There's no clear entrance to the pyramid. Twice in this story, they have grappling hooks that they use, not dissimilar from the one from Batman 1989. The one who does the exploring is Broussard, which again is the replacement for John Hurt's character, but this is a young guy, again, physically indistinguishable from the Malconis character, aside from the color of the hair. He's a little bit more cocky. He reminds me a little bit of Hudson from Aliens. He's an adventurer. He's an explorer. So he goes up the grappling hook. He climbs to the top of the pyramid. There's a hole at the top at the temple, at the pointy part, whatever you want to call it. He notes that there's not enough room up there for more than one person, although later on a couple more make it up there. And he decides he wants to go in to the pyramid. His captain is very concerned about that. And she tells him, look, you can go in there for 10 minutes. And then after that, you got to come back. So he gets down inside and there's these alien hieroglyphics all over the place. And there's all these tentacles on the walls. It very strongly recalls H.P. Lovecraft imagery. And I suppose they were trying to reach backwards to a time before Giger had influenced so much the alien visuals. Just as has happened in the original movies, the guy gets too close to one of the eggs. The eggs, I thought maybe they would go with the hen egg like they did with the movie poster and the teaser trailer. It looks dissimilar from the Geiger eggs, so it would be a callback without them having to break their brains. But instead, they just made eggs that were kind of had these squirrely tentacle things on them. It wasn't strong visuals, and it wasn't different enough at the same time. The facehugger comes out and attaches itself to this fellow, Broussard. It looks like a squid. Like if you've ever seen Old Boy, where the dude eats the octopus live, it's kind of like that. The head features are less distinctive. It's purple, and it's just sort of a mass that attaches to him. So not very visually striking. As in the movie, the away team come back to the vessel. The Ripley stand-in, Roby, refuses to let them in because they'd be breaking quarantine. The guys on the ship argue with her. Eventually, she relents based on her captain's orders. Once the female captain gets inside, she actually slaps Roby, and Roby ultimately says that she deserved the slapping. Ripley wouldn't have backed down the way that Roby does in this one. They try to remove the facehugger. It has concentrated acid for blood. It bleeds through several stories of their away ship. They're afraid that they're not going to be able to take off with the damage it was doing, but thankfully it finally petered out. They decide to leave the facehugger alone. It eventually falls off on its own. Unfortunately, it begins to decompose rather quickly, and as part of its decomposition, the acid starts to come out of it and start causing problems for the ship again, so the captain swiftly picks up the carcass and throws it out the hatch. They're still on the planetoid at this point, so there's not an airlock necessarily. It's just the hatch they came in and out of. Ultimately, the repairs that were necessary are made to the away ship. They return to the main ship, again, the Snark. Everybody's getting ready to go back into hypersleep. Now, they've made their first contact with dead aliens, at least. But Broussard's really hungry, so they decide to have one more meal beforehand. Chest-bursting scene happens. It's another squid, though. In the hieroglyphs, they eventually determine, A, the SOS was not an SOS, but rather a warning for people to stay away, and B, the hieroglyphs, through translation, they determine, show the various life cycles of the alien, the various stages of it. And so there's a stage where it's a facehugger and there's a stage where it's a chest burster, but the artists of the comic book don't really differentiate the two. They both just look like squids. It's frustrating that they both are similar enough to what was in the movie, but also similar to each other. The second stage alien gets away, and having killed one of their team members, the other people move around the ship to try to collect this thing. They can't go into hyperspace sleep without having dealt with this alien, since they would be sitting ducks if they did so. They get netting, they get cattle prods, they go after it. By the time it's located, it's in its final form, and again, it's very familiar. It essentially looks like a dulled down variation of the Geiger alien. It's somewhat similar to the N'Gari from Uncanny X-Men, the N'Gari being demons that somewhat notoriously ripped off the xenomorphs from Alien. The difference is that this creature doesn't have eyes, it's a little spikier, and it's not drawn by John Byrne in his prime. The alien rips Malconus's head off, and the body's still running like a decapitated chicken based on the dialogue. I don't remember that being in the movie. I thought that was a nice touch. Very horrific. So Faust, the black guy, finds the Star Beast. The plan is to try to shoot the creature out the airlock, because he happens to be playing around there. He's eating Malconus near the airlock. Faust calls the main crew to open up the airlock in hopes of sending the alien out. The alien notices him, shoots out of the room very quickly. The airlock is open, and then Faust is the one who ends up getting pulled partially out. What ultimately happens is the doors close on him. They bisect him. He's dead, but the body has still got enough mass where it's keeping the door open, and so you have this explosive decompression throughout the spaceship. By the time they manage to seal off that section and jettison it, they've lost all but 6 hours of oxygen in the ship. They think about, well, what do we get in the escape hatch? There's only one life pod in there. It won't work. So they decide, well, what do we do this? We'll put explosives that we use for the mining into this escape pod, and then we'll lure the alien in there, and then we'll blow the alien up. While trying to effect this plan, there's all this debris floating around, and Broussard's corpse hits up against one of the windows. I don't recall that happening in Alien. I think something like that happened in Outland, the sci-fi remake of High Noon that Sean Connery was in a few years later. Another thing that happens is that an alien captures Standard and Hunter. Eventually, two things happen. One is the cooling system for the large ship, the Snark, is turned off with the thinking that they would maybe blow up that ship. I don't remember what the rationale was. Roby finds her captain. She's been cocooned. She's apparently been partially devoured as well. We don't really get into the whole chestburster life cycle that much in this version. Apparently, the adult aliens are devouring the humans, which would make more sense if you had the small alien become a large alien after eating people, because how did this creature get the mass? Maybe it got into the food supplies. That's never explained. What's weird is when the captain is found cocooned, she's conscious. She asks to be killed, like we see in the movies. But she also points out that Malconus had been turned into a second Star Beast, and that's the Star Beast that ate Hunter. I don't know how any of that was supposed to work. I assume that means there were two Star Beasts running around, and that's why they appear to be in more places than they should logically be, but the Star Beast is also extremely fast. I don't know. Roby honors her captain's request. She hits her with the flamethrower. Not a great way to die, but that's how it happens. She tries to restart the cooling system in the Snark, but it had progressed too far. It was going to blow up anyway, so she had no choice but to go to the escape pod. She gets in there, and unfortunately, she's in there with an alien. It plays out pretty much the same way it does in the movie. The main difference is that Roby had brought some of the precious metals with her onto the escape ship, and she also had the decapitated space jockey's head to prove that they had made any contact, which Ripley could have really used in the second Aliens movie. So overall, what I think of the project, I thought it was fine. It was nice. It's a good-looking book. They had recruited the artist first. It was a Brazilian artist, and I'm going to butcher his name, Guilherme Balbi. This is a fellow who had worked for Dark Horse previously on their adaptation of the Predators movie that Robert Rodriguez, I think, directed. He also did one of the Jim Cameron Avatar miniseries, both for Dark Horse. He worked with other companies as well. And he, being Brazilian, had brought in a couple of his buddies who would be able to communicate with easier. The screenplay was adapted by Cristiano Sexas, who has not done any other comic book work. I have no reason to think that the adaptation isn't faithful to the original script. I think to hardcore fans, they probably had access to the original Star Beast script and would be able to tell whether or not there were major deviations. So I assume it was faithful, and I think it flows fairly well as a 5-issue miniseries. I don't know if anything was taken away from the characters. I was under the impression that a lot of the characterization that we're familiar with from the movie was added later on by other screenwriters, which we'll talk about in another episode. There's not a lot of personality between them. So when they start dying, you don't really care because they never mattered to you in the first place. It's very by the numbers. It feels more like a ripoff of Alien than Alien, because so much of what is Alien is that personality and that texture that you get from the people that aren't Dan O'Bannon. But it is disappointing because O'Bannon is the guy who wrote Return of the Living Dead, which is just flush with personality among the characters, among the monsters even, that it's weird to see such a flat story here. And frankly, having watched Dark Star, which only has 4 people in it, 4 white males, all 4 of which have facial hair, 2 of whom have dark hair, kind of curly to boot, 2 of whom have full beards, 2 of which have mustaches, 2 of whom are blonde. Both of the blondes also are the ones who have mustaches. Both of the brunettes are also the ones who have the full beards. These guys could have been super interchangeable, but the screenplay makes them very distinct personalities. One of them has a barely concealed simmering violence about him. One of them is very neglectful and distracted. One of them is irritatingly hypervigilant. violent and whiny and demanding. And one of them is sort of the zen cool guy. For these four people to have so much personality, and for none of the people in the Star Beast adaptation script having any personality, really, for the most part, if you didn't have the artwork to differentiate them, you couldn't tell one character from the other. I have to wonder if that was the original script or if that's in the adaptation. I don't know. I'm doing a podcast about the comic books, not screenplays floating around on the internet. Now, getting to the artwork, let's talk about the colors. The coloring in this book is by Candace Hahn. I believe, again, that this is another Brazilian artist. I am, frankly, a coloring bigot. I feel like coloring is the least essential part of any given comic book. I've got a shelves of comic books that are essential editions that they put out cheap on newsprint, where it's the same as the original comic books printed in the 50s, 60s, 70s, just in black and white. They read just fine. I do like colors, but especially for the older comic books, I'm perfectly fine with flats. Most of the time when I do a comic book podcast, I don't talk about the colorists. I just omit them entirely. But there is something I've noticed in recent years. I collect original artwork. I don't buy previously produced artwork. I get commissions. And so I often will vet artists to see if this is a person that I would actually want to pay money to give me a drawing. In doing that, I go through a lot of sites like Comic Art Fans that show the original artwork to see what kind of work artists are producing. And in recent years, I have looked at some of these artists that are not as familiar to me because I just don't read as many comic books as I used to. The increasing loss of physically produced artwork and the increasing reliance on digital work has really changed how comic books are produced. Back in my day, you'd have a pencil artist, an ink artist, and a colorist. So the pencil artist would bring most of the style to the book, but wouldn't necessarily fill everything in. So you'd have an inker come in who either maybe couldn't quite do the same level of storytelling or wasn't quite as stylish, but would add weight to the characters, would fill in areas that had open space, fill in inks, enrich it, give depth. One of the things I love about comic books is that interplay between two different artists, the style of the penciler and the style of the inker and how they interrelate to one another. But because of digital, you're seeing more and more, they're just taking the original pencils and doing contrasts to them, and then you don't have an inker anymore. So art is rougher looking than it used to be. It's often a singular vision rather than a collaborative work. What you've also seen is a greater reliance on coloring. Modern fans like coloring that looks like computer generated artwork. They like lots of different hues and tones and such. You can't seem to get away with flats anymore. If you do flats, it's a particular stylist choice, not a natural result of the comic book production process. I don't know if maybe they reallocated the funds that used to go to an inker to a colorist, but it seems to me like the colorist has a much more active role in the final presentation than they used to have. Increasingly, their role is more important than even the penciler. And I bring this up in this particular instance, and I've seen this in a few other instances, where I'll look at the page, I'm liking what I'm seeing, and then I look closer at the actual line art, or I see that line art in black and white, and I see that the pencils is just okay. And it isn't until the colorist goes in there and adds all those cool hues and stuff that you get a really impressive, comprehensive page. I'm not disparaging the artist on this book. I think that the artist is solid, but I do see a lot of gimmicks. One thing in particular that I think is a digital quirk, where there was a lot of flack given artists back in the 90s because they didn't want to draw backgrounds. They wanted to put intense detailing on their figures and then completely forget their backgrounds. That age is obviously over with now. What they do often, more like the Japanese artists, where the figures are more loose and the backgrounds might be more dense, but they're using more and more digital tricks. Again, back in the day, they used to paste on tones and stuff. Now what I'm seeing a lot of is you'll have like a black space and then you'll have these lighter areas where you can see intensive cross-hatching, and you'll see stuff that looks like it's computer-generated intermingled with the line art. And good colorists can make it all work. It pulls it all together. Where when I look at the original pages, or I look in the black and white pages, and those digital farts are much more prominent. Literally every page on this, in a single panel, all that cross-hatchy stuff looks good. But when you go after page of it, it just really gets tiresome. I noticed that a lot of what I liked about the artwork I was seeing was the colorist. So I really needed to give her a specific shout out. One other thing that is kind of neat about the comic book series too, is they did do variant covers that were drawn by Walt Simonson, who was the illustrator for the original Alien adaptation. That was a nice touch. But at the same time, it's kind of a gimmick unto itself, because that artwork is so completely different from the interior artwork that you would definitely want that to be a variant cover and not the main cover.
This has been a Raw Old Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
But I know you guys will make do. Keep up the good work, men.